Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Paul Lisnick. Welcome to Behind the Curtain. It's my opportunity to veer away a little bit from the law and politics you see me cover every day on WGN-TV and talk about the world of art and theater here on the podcast. And today, you know, we kind of touch a little bit of law as well, just because of the topic, but not maybe in the way you think. You'll understand in just a moment. Joining me is actually an old friend of mine. I haven't seen him in a million years, but he's made a name for himself in the world of theater as the author at playwright of a play called Thrill Me, which has been produced pretty much everywhere in the world, has a lifespan of its own beyond 30 years. And he's done other things as well. We'll talk about them. But joining me is Stephen Dolganoff, who Steve and I don't think we've seen each other face to face since 2006 or so.
That's right, Paul. I was just thinking about that. That was when Thrill Me was performed in Chicago, and I got to stay with you and meet you. And it was wonderful and see that fantastic production that they did there.
And you collect goofy things like I do. So I even got some things from you, which are still here and all of that, like my I Love Lucy. All right. Anyway, so congratulations. The reason we're talking today is because you just have a book published called Thrill Maker. We see the sign behind you. And it's the story of Thrill Me from the very beginning. I loved reading it because I followed you for all these years, but I didn't know all the details that went behind it. So for folks who may not be familiar with the play, and you do this right at the beginning of the book, kind of get it out of the way, sort of like, here's what it's about. So let's all get on the same page. So What is, because everybody, and certainly here in Chicago, this is a story people know.
Oh, yes. Thrill Me is the Leopold and Loeb story. It is the true story of the two guys who were teenagers, who were fans of Nietzsche, getting ready to study to be lawyers, who lived in Chicago, and who decided on a whim to commit a thrill killing. And they murdered a young man named Bobby Franks, a young boy, and were caught very soon after, were represented by the great lawyer Clarence Darrow, who won by sparing them from the death penalty, and they received life sentences instead. And it is quite a story. It has been made into movies and plays. And when I came across a story 30 years ago this year, which I can't believe it's been that long, I was sitting in this exact very chair when I came across it pretty much and started writing
it. Which means you have rent control there in New York.
Yes, I do. Not as good as you might think. But when I came across the story, I realized that it had never been told to my knowledge as a piece of musical theater. And I thought, you know, I was a young guy then. I thought, well, this will be just great. And took a long time to get it finally produced, but once it did, it's been off and running, and it hasn't been out of production since the first day it was ever produced.
And you know, it's funny because people would say, well, who would take a murder story, it's what it is, event, and turn it into a musical for the stage? But the truth is, actually, since then, American Psycho, I mean, there have been other stories like this which were set to music. But let's get into your weird mind for a little bit, because I certainly understand the fascination with the Leopold and Loeb story. It is fascinating. And by the way, that makes you have a strong tie to Chicago, where you've been, because it happened here. But what was it 30 years ago? I know you started writing in 1994. That said, this is the stuff of musicals.
Well, I wanted to do two things. I had an idea to do a two-character musical about an intense relationship between two people. And it could have been anybody. It could have been anything. It could have been any subject. I was sort of ruminating on that. And I also was a big fan of true crime. So I also had the idea to separately write a true crime musical. I didn't know what it would be. When I came across the story of Leopold and Loeb, I realized that it could be both of those things, an intense story of a relationship between two people and true crime. And it wasn't so much the crime itself that I was interested in writing about. It was the relationship between the two of them, two men who were in love with each other or had at least a intimate relationship with each other in the 1920s, which one was more popular, one was more bookish. It was a very hot stuff at the time. And I really wanted to explore that, a power play. What's it like when you love someone so much that you would do anything that they asked? including even murder a kid for the thrill. And I loved that idea. And as I say, I was very young and I thought, oh, this will be a great idea. You know, anyone will want to do this. And I'm glad I didn't think twice, because if I had, I probably wouldn't have even done it, because I never knew that 30 years later, it would be my life's work. I would be dealing with it literally every day, whether it's consulting on casting a production, traveling to see a production. Productions are done all over the world, or talking to a director or negotiating a contract. Talking to you today, writing the book about it, it's literally been up my entire life for 30 years.
And in fact, even again, back when we met in 2006, who would have guessed? Because you do give us the timeline in the book. And at this point, it's had over 200 staging, 25 countries, 17 languages. By the way, who does the translation? I can't imagine you speak Korean and all these other languages.
I wish I spoke all those languages. No. Yes, as you said, it's been translated into 17 languages. The producer that licenses the rights is responsible for the translation. And they usually, for Thrill Me, I like to give them permission to translate it the best way they see fit for their culture, for their country. Sometimes humor doesn't transfer. Sometimes metaphors don't transfer. And sometimes the American sensibility that I wrote it with doesn't transfer or translate. And instead of making them go as verbatim, word by word, as close as possible to my American text, I want them to make it as successful as they can. And I think that's been the key to the success of it. As you said, it's been done in Korea. It's been running there for 17 years. And I think that's because I let them make it universal to Korea. For example, in Korea, it doesn't take place in Chicago and their names aren't Leopold and Loeb. It doesn't take place in Korea. It just takes place somewhere.
And they don't use names. You wrote about that. And you don't even use names, right? It's like you, right. They don't designate right. a name. So right. you had to give them permission to do that.
Exactly. And I'm only too happy to, because I want the show to be a success. They want the show to be a success. And if I was saying, no, you've got it. It's got to be Chicago. It's got to be like this. My funny joke or my really wonderful lyric has to be the same. Then it just wouldn't be as successful. And audiences of different cultures, I don't think would embrace it as much as they have.
And by the way, what is the reason? I mean, I did read about that as far as in Seoul, where, you know, no names and all that. What was the reason behind that?
I think they felt that a Korean audience, and that was the first major translated production. It's since been done in Japan, China, all over Europe. That was the first production to really be translated. They felt that culturally, if Asian actors were playing men from Chicago named Nathan and Richard, but they were Asian, it would be distancing and it would be, you know, a cultural distance or a cultural difference. And they wanted it to feel like this could be our own story in Korea. So that's why everything was made deliberately vague. So you could imagine not that these Asian actors are somehow Caucasian men from Chicago in 1920s, but Korean actors or any actor. You could imagine it being, you could imagine yourself up there on the stage. I believe that's why they wanted to do it. And they clearly made the right decision. Now, in China, they did the same thing for several years. But about 2 years ago, they decided that they wanted to change it. And now the characters are known as Nathan and Richard. And it takes place in Chicago, in China. In Japan, it's still vague. In Korea, it's still vague. But whatever they're doing, it works.
Well, and it's important that you let them do that, because, I mean, certainly you could have stepped in, as I'm sure many playwrights would, and said, you're not going to play with my work that way. You're not going to do that. And then maybe it wouldn't even, you know, be put up. Who knows?
Exactly.
A question you ask in the book at the end, but I want to ask it now, is, you know, a lot of playwrights, I guess, I'm not a playwright, but a lot of playwrights, you would think they write their work, they get it up, whatever, congratulations, and we're done. And then you move on. And you have written many other things.
Yes.
But for some reason, this work has never left your control. And I don't mean that in a legal way. It's never left your sight. What is it about this play, this musical, that you just, I'll word it my way, you won't let it go, if you know what I mean, right?
I Well, I love it, and I'm very lucky, and I'm very grateful. But being that it's not a household name musical, it's not Wicked, it's not The Phantom of the Opera, it's not Sweeney Todd, it's none of those things. I still have to grease the wheels, and I still have to do the social media posts and promote it. You know, it has a life of its own in Asia, but because it doesn't have that big of a life in, let's say, even parts of the United States, by constantly promoting the Asian production, then it gets eyeballs in the United States. By constantly promoting the European production, people in Australia might take a look at it. So I always have to keep it going until, you know, until the day comes when it, you know, becomes more of a household name in this country. It is in Asia, but, you know, it's not here yet. And, you know, I want to be able to keep being able to make my living as a writer, which I've been extremely fortunate to be able to do. So I just have to keep doing it. And somehow, it wasn't even by design. Somehow it's just sort of happened because I'm so accessible, because, you know, I think people don't perceive me as, you know, like untouchable, like Stephen Sondheim would have been. You know, they see me on Facebook and they'll write me and say, hey, I'm playing Nathan Leopold in a production of Thrill Me. I'd love to pick your brain about it. And they feel like I'm approachable. And I guess it's because I am. And then that'll lead to the director has a question. And then, you know, and then they'll want me to do a talk back, or they'll want me to come to the opening. You know, it feeds itself.
By the way, when all this started, you also write that you actually, your intent was not to be a playwright. It was to be an actor. Right. You get the best of both worlds, because in many of these productions, you actually have played in the show. And so, which has to freak other people out when the playwright is one of the actors. But talk about that, that growth, that shift from, I just want to be an actor into New York to, well, maybe I'll just act in a play that I write.
Well, my original intent was always to be an actor. That was every goal that I had.
And you did so. I mean, you did do that.
I did. I was an actor all through high school. I got into NYU's acting program, you know, their Bachelor of Fine Arts program. And I came to New York. I was auditioning. I was studying at NYU. And very quickly, I realized that I didn't think I was going to be the best. And I thought that there was always going to be someone better than me, or similar to me, or the same as me, and you're taller than me. You know how it is for an actor. But I had always tinkered with writing as a hobby, and I always thought that might be something kind of interesting to me, because while there's still competition for writers, but no one writes like anybody else. You know what I mean? Like any work, with whether it's a book or a play, that's always going to be original to the artist, or a painting or anything like that. So I wrote a musical while I was at NYU, and NYU decided to produce it while I was still a student there. And that really set me off on the path of, okay, it's time to give up acting. I transferred into their dramatic writing program, and I graduated with a degree in writing, and I started writing, and I did wrote a bunch of small shows that were done in New York, done here in New York, which culminated with Thrill Me. And then in one of those crazy show business stories straight out of the movie 42nd Street, an actor had to leave the show unexpectedly early. And it came down to either I took over the role of Nathan Leopold, or the show would have to close in New York soon after its off-Broadway debut. Because of timing, New York was, of course, full of other actors, but it was a matter of getting someone who could come in almost instantaneously and learn the huge role. And the producers...
Were you off book quickly, by the way? I mean, even though you wrote it, but were you off book?
I was. You know, the producer asked me to do it. I said no. I said, that's crazy. I could never do it. They said, well, we're going to have to close. I couldn't let that happen. We had just gotten a rave review in the New York Times, and I knew all kinds of things would be happening if we could just keep running. And so I decided to take the part, because I thought if I had stayed an actor, it probably would have been a good part for me. But I had never had a part that big. It's a very large role. And my co-star in the show, who was playing Richard Loeb, an actor named Doug Krieger, he was just so phenomenal. I was so worried to go on stage with him. But I did. I faced my fears. I went up there. I seized it. And I kind of never looked back. And because I stayed in the show, and because the show was still running, That was when the Korean producers came to see it. That was when we got the deal to record the album. That's when the play publishers came to see it. So if I hadn't taken over the role, there wouldn't have been a show for them to see, and I would have a very different life right now. And then I was asked to do the show in many other places, so that was a lot of fun.
By the way, I think this book serves two purposes. Number one, it is your story and it tells what to do. But as I was reading it, I'm thinking, you know what? And so I send this message out for other people who want to be a playwright or want to do this. It's also a guide. Now, you don't write it as a guide. You don't say, do this, because it's your story. But as I'm reading it, I thought, no, this could be a guide. And you literally do. There are moments you say, okay, time to get a producer. So you do walk. Was that your intention? Was it just to tell your story? Or was it, no, I want this to be a guide for other playwrights?
I really wanted it to be a guide, not only for other playwrights, but for other artists. I think it's applicable to just about anyone, especially because, like I say, it's not a household name famous musical, but yet I make my living off of it. And it's always in production somewhere in the world. And I really wanted to share that with young playwrights or even older playwrights, that it can happen, you can be successful, and you don't have to be Andrew Lloyd Webber or Stephen Sondheim or Rodgers and Hammerstein. And everyone isn't going to have the same path that I did. And in fact, some of the things that I did back in the 90s, you know, don't even exist anymore. Things are done so differently now. But I wanted to tell exactly what I did, exactly how I did it. And that while I had many lucky breaks, I was very lucky that it got into the hands of the right people at the right time, and I had the right opportunities at the right time. But the most important thing was that I did it myself. I didn't just write the play and say, you know, I was lucky to have an agent say, okay, here, agent, send it out, and I'll just sit by the phone and wait, which I think is something that a lot of people do, or take the rejections to heart, because believe me, I had a drawer full of rejections for Thrill Me before anyone was ever brave enough to do it. And that drawer full of rejections rejected the exact same musical that's being done all over the world today. It was just, a lot of people were afraid of it because of the subject matter, but I always believed in it. And I knew that if it could just be done once, I would be satisfied and would be successful. And the night of its very first performance, I was satisfied. I thought, I don't care if it's ever done again, because I was artistically fulfilled. And I think because of that, because I was so happy as an artist and so pleased with how it turned out, everything else was gravy. And I wasn't greedy. I was grateful. I was grateful to every producer, every director, every actor that contributed in their way to the success of the show and that are still contributing to this day. And I wanted the book to also be a lesson in how we have to respect ourselves as artists, never give up something that we believe in, never feel that we have to listen to something someone else tells you. I was told many times, as you read in the book, well, if you just changed this, or if you just added this, this might make it more commercial, or this might make it more stageable. And I had to hold to my guns and say, no, it's got to be this way, because this is my vision, and I'm willing to suffer the consequences. Yeah. You know, it's got to be what I want to write. It can't be what the director wants to write, or what, you know, there have been theaters, you know, that happened years after the success, which I write about in the book, that sort of took shocking liberties that I found out about. And, you know, it's very disheartening when, you know, a theater decides that, well, you know, maybe if we did this, it would be better here. And then they do that without permission. And it's really like a knife to the heart, really, because I feel like you could write your own musical about Leopold and Lowe if you wanted to, and you don't need mine. So I wanted to tell people those stories. I wanted to tell people that it's not all smooth sailing. It's not just a theater licenses your script and then they do it, or they translate it and they do it. Sometimes there are theaters that think they can get away with changing your work or adding to your work or rewriting your work.
We see that in the book too. There are moments when things do happen, right? And you catch it. I just want to ask you a quick question about your influence, because Rodgers and Hammerstein, who you mentioned, would not write this show. But Stephen Sondheim, who wrote Assassins and Sweeney Todd, Stephen would have written this show. You knew Sondheim, right? You had some interaction with him?
He did come to see the show, and it was a very exciting night when he came to see the show off Broadway. I was afraid to talk to him, but I was also, he also had years earlier been on the committee that selected it for development through a program that the Drama Guild used to have to develop. They would choose three musicals a year to develop, and he was on the select committee that chose it. And I believe that's why years later he came to see it off Broadway. So was he
a primary influence for you?
I find that I was more influenced by Candor and Ebb and Stephen Schwartz.
Okay.
You know, things like Cabaret, Kiss of the Spider Woman, Chicago, that type of a thing. I think
that's all Candor and Ebb. That's Candor and Ebb stuff. What if Stephen Schwartz? Because this is pre-Wicked and stuff.
Yes. So like Pippin, The Magic Show, that kind of music, you know, everything in a minor key, everything with a minor chord. That's sort of how I hear my music. But when I'm compared to Sondheim a lot in reviews, which is very flattering, and then sometimes I'll read that it's nothing like Sondheim, very often it's compared to Kurt Weill. And I feel like, gosh, I don't think I really know much Kurt Weill music, but I'm always very flattered. People hear what they want to hear. I chose to not write it to sound like what I perceived as 1920s sounding music. I just wanted it to sound like the music that comes out of me. And sometimes people will come up to me and say, I just love all of the 1920s riffs and the 1920s touches that you put into the piano score. And I smile and I nod, but I'm thinking I didn't do that. Or if I'm glad that you're hearing it, but I don't think I did that.
By the way, the minor chords, that's just about klezmer music and being Jewish. Let me just toss that in there.
Well, true.
You throw an E minor in there and you got a whole thing. by the way, I want to talk a little bit about some of the changes, because this, I know you wrote the first draft in 6 weeks before you started to look for a producer, but there's these little things. And when I say changes, some people might say, oh, you know, like throw that song out, bring that song in. And there might've been some of that. But what I love about it, specifically what I have in my head, was there's a time years later when you add a pocket watch, and that for you was this huge change. Even the nickname of Babe, there's a story that goes along to that, to what was, so it's what's real, what's not, what little changes make a big deal difference to you. You just talk about some of those tweaks that have made an impact for you.
Well, when I was doing research on The Real Leopold and Loeb, I wanted to respect this. I mean, they were murderers. They were horrible people. There's no defending them, but I did feel that I wanted to tell the story and honor history. But drama is not a biography, is not a nonfiction book, is not a, is not supposed to be 100% faithful to the facts. So I had to do a lot of tweaking and, I guess you could say, changing of the facts to make it a better drama. For example, Richard Loeb had a brother named Tommy, and Tommy was their intended first victim. And when I first started writing this in 1994, I couldn't figure out if Tommy Loeb was still alive. He might have been. I later found out he wasn't, but he could have been. And I didn't want to bring his name into it. So I created a fictional brother. I just gave him a different name. There were other things, like when they were luring the victim to his death, it was done regarding a tennis racket, and I'm going to buy a new tennis racket. Can I see your tennis racket? And that's how they sort of lure him to the scene of the crime. And I just didn't think that sounded very exciting for a play to start talking about a tennis racket. So instead I made it about a car, you know, a roadster, you know, come into my new roadster, I'll give you a ride home. That seemed more dramatic. But over the years, I'm always asked, why did you change it? Why did you change it? As if I, you know, went into a time machine and rewrote history. I always say I didn't change anything. I just dramatized it in a different way. And the book now answers all of those questions. So there in chapter one, I say, this is what it was in real life. This is how I changed, and this is why I changed it. Part of it was because I only had two people. I only had Leopold and Loeb. And the whole story had to unfold with the two of them. And so things like the cops, the police investigation, their families, you know, the family of the victim, the lawyers, all of that was very important to the story, of course, but I only had the point of view of the two of them. So that's how I adapted the story. And then regarding the pocket watch, it's interesting you say it. The pocket watch is a little throwaway prop that's mentioned in the script that, you know, Nathan takes a look at his watch to realize Richard's late. And that's how it was always done. When I started playing the role in New York, I did it that way. But then when I was asked to do the show in other cities, I did it in Seattle, I did it in Buffalo, I did it in Tampa Bay, Florida. I got a nicer watch and I decided, what if Nathan is always fiddling with that watch? And what if he's got like the watch chain on his vest, you know, like they would do in the olden days. And he was always trying to make sure that the chains were hanging evenly. And he was always checking the time and checking the time. And not to be too distracting, but to give me sort of stage business. And it added so much to the character that I mentioned it in later editions of the script. I mean, I didn't write it in and say, okay, open the watch now and play with the chain, but it added so much to me for me that I started suggesting it.
And there's all these kind of things. What I love, let's talk about Chicago for a moment, since that's where I am. A lot of my listeners and viewers are in Chicago. And at the same time, it's so important to the story. It's where it's all set. But specifically, two things to address just briefly. One, it's 2006, where the Bailiwick Theater Company, it doesn't exist anymore, but they put on the show. That's when you and I met. That's when you stayed with me. I never knew at that time, but I read it from the book that they actually put on an old version of the script that you didn't realize was happening. But then prior to that, you had been invited to the Chicago Historical Society. And I'm pretty sure that was the first time you actually saw actual artifacts from Leopold and Loeb. You've already written the story. Now you're seeing these things. What a blowaway experience that must have been.
It was incredible. That was 2004. Yeah. And it was after the first New York production, but before the Off-Broadway production. And the Timeline Theater Company in Chicago was producing a concert version of Thrill Me at the Chicago Historical Society.
I have to tell you, I'm very active with Timeline Theater, History Boys, and all that. I was just at their gala last weekend. I did not know about this piece. I'm going to have to bring this up to PJ, who you probably worked
with. Yes, I did. Yes. Tell him.
Well, I'm going to mention that to him, but they're building a new theater, whatever. That's a story for another time. But I would like Timeline. How fantastic. It's perfect for them.
Yes. Timeline did it at the Chicago Historical Society, because which is now, I believe, called the Chicago History Museum.
Yeah, probably.
And they had an exhibit of Leopold and Loeb artifacts at that time. And so Timeline did a concert version of Thrill Me there. And I wasn't able to get into Chicago in time to see it. But I was able to get to Chicago to see the exhibit, and they had acquired some items from Thrill Me for the exhibit too. Some of my original notes, a poster from the show, a program from the show. So my work was there among the real crime scene evidence and the real, you know, photographs.
An actual artifact. By the way, you show up in lots of things. Remember, I once called you about, this is I think the last time we talked, I was reading a book about Leopold and Loeb, to have that author on my show. And she wrote about your play within her historic book.
Right. The show's been mentioned in many books that are theater related, about plays and musicals, books that are about Leopold and Loeb that, you know, talk about the different dramatic versions of it. So I've been very lucky. There's sort of a bibliography, I guess you would call it, in the back of Thrillmaker that lists every book that I know of that has it mentioned in it, which is just such an honor and so exciting and something that I never could have possibly imagined.
Well, what's also, people might say, why hasn't it been made a movie? Yes, you do address that making a movie. What I loved about that was, I mean, how Hollywood is this? Where it goes through all these phases of everything from, you got to have some nudity and sex in this thing. And then 5 minutes later, somebody else, he needs a girlfriend in this thing. And just all the, and so that just, I know that you wrote the screenplay, but I think if I'm right, it's sitting in your drawer because you're not satisfied with the way Hollywood wants to deal with it.
Well, I had a very small deal with a producer in Hollywood a few years back, an option to do a film version where this producer would then shop it to larger film companies. And the first step was to have a screenplay ready to go. And We went through several drafts of the screenplay.
And you had, by the way, you had hassle about that. There were people who went, you don't know how to write a screenplay.
Well, first, he didn't want me to write the screenplay because I didn't have produced screenwriting credits. Of course, half of my degree is in screenwriting, and I'm definitely an expert in writing for Ilmity. So I said that if I don't write the screenplay, or at least the first draft of the screenplay, then there is no deal. I'm not interested. You know, this wasn't like Sony Pictures or Warner Brothers came to me to make the movie. This was an independent producer who was very nice and loved the script of the play very much. So I was very grateful. We entered into a deal. It was a short-term deal. I wrote the script, the screenplay that is, wrote several drafts. And I have to tell you, I was thrilled with it. It opens it up. I should send it to you to read because it takes place all throughout Chicago. Any place that was still, that was in Chicago in 1924 is in that screenplay.
So the Disney store.
And there was, no Disney store, but like anything that was there, and it takes place all through it, and it really opens it up. And it, instead of being a two character musical or two character piece, there's tons of people, the family members, the lawyers, everyone you name is in it, but we only focus on Leopold and Loeb. And so they're the only ones with dialogue. We just miss Leopold having, you know, dinner with his family, and they're all sitting at the table, but Loeb comes in and he gets up from the table, and it's just a scene with them. And that's how the whole script worked. So all of that worked really well, but you know, the producer had ideas like you said, for a girlfriend for Nathan and all kinds of other crazy ideas. And, you know, I had met my obligations. I had turned in the drafts I needed to turn in. And I said, that's as far as I'm going to go. And, you know, and then our deal expired and the script is mine again. And I love it. And maybe someone will make a movie out of it someday. I would love
it. By the way, this whole, the whole gay thing that goes on here, it's hard to, I mean, we don't really know that both of them were gay.
We don't know. We know they had a sexual relationship with each other. We know that, Loeb was stabbed in prison years later due to making a pass at another inmate. We know that Leopold later was married. Those are the facts.
It's also the 1920s and the 30s, and who knows what's going on.
Exactly. But there was definitely a physical relationship between them. And Thrill Me takes that to the level of that they were a weird couple.
Yeah, something going on.
Power play between them.
Less than a minute left, but I do want to ask you this. You sort of wrap the book with the end, making the point, I have nothing left to prove. What a great way to just kind of wrap this part of your life, even though you can continue to control it.
Yes, I've done everything I possibly could do. And you're right. I don't have anything left to prove other than to tell the story of how I did it, what the past 30 years have been like. I literally take a trip down memory lane. I wanted to do it before I forgot everything. And luckily I remembered a lot, and anything I didn't quite remember correctly, I apologize for, but it's been the gift that keeps on giving. It's a wonderful story. It's part of Chicago history. And now it's part of musical theater history around the world. And I'm grateful every day for it. And writing the book was a total joy. And I hope everyone reads it.
Well, and reading the book was a total joy. Thrill Maker. Let's do a sequel called Thrill Seeker. We'll do that. But anyway, Stephen Dolganoff, the book is called Thrill Maker, available on Amazon and everywhere you get better books. Congratulations. It's a really fine work. And it's been what a pleasure knowing you for all these years and getting to read the story, which I thought I would get a whole chapter devoted to me. I didn't, but so be it.
That'll be in Thrill Seeker.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Stephen.